Hello, I'm Rachel Babin from the Oncology Podcast, part of the Oncology Network. Welcome to the Oncology Journal Club podcast, a trans-Tasman podcast offering expert analysis and discussion of the latest oncology papers. Regular listeners will be familiar with our format. The hosts present main papers or interviews with guests alongside some quick bite papers, thoughtful discussion and entertaining banter. Dr. Kate Clark gets us started with a paper she looked up to solve a clinical conundrum. It explores neoadjuvant immunotherapy for patients with DMMR, MSI-high GI cancers. We have highlights from our host Craig Underhill's separate The OJC Meets interview with Ashwe Gunjur about the microbiome's role in predicting patient response to immunotherapy, followed by insightful discussion from the team who advise you to ignore the microbiome at your peril. Professor Christopher Jackson talks us through the fascinating long-term results of organ preservation in patients with rectal adenocarcinoma. We have a wide-ranging selection of quick bites covering sexual health, H. pylori, re-challenge after hypersensitivity reactions, and low-grade adverse events. We also include an impassioned debate about resource allocation and treatment de-intensification and the role of the oncologist in balancing new treatments and limited public health resources. Please see the show notes on oncologynetwork.com.au for papers, links and full bios of the host and guest speaker. We hope you enjoy listening. This is Rachel Babin and this is the Oncology Journal Club podcast.
G'day, kia ora. It's a great pleasure to welcome back everybody to episode 3 of the Oncology Journal Club podcast, Across the Ditch. Welcome, Professor Chris Jackson and Dr. Kate Clark. How's the cricket series going? Australia versus New Zealand? Had to get that in.
You know the answer, Craig, or you wouldn't ask.
I think I'm going to give that cricket question crickets.
All right, so let's get straight into it. Chris, I took a question on notice in the last episode. You had a question about whether no pain, no gain, whether there was importance to try and elicit immune-related adverse event giving a checkpoint inhibitor because there's this relationship between having an adverse event and doing better in lung cancer, is a paper we discussed at the last episode. So I took that on notice. I did a little bit of research and we've got a link to a paper that was called Cancer Immunotherapy Dosing, a Pharmacokinetic Pharmacodynamic Perspective. And so the short answer is the no pain, no gain is not really an issue. It's different to chemotherapy. That's why we've evolved to going from a BSA or weight-based dosing to a fixed dose of checkpoint inhibitor and longer time intervals. So there's some pharmacokinetic evidence that, you know, you get these long trough levels of the drug. We don't understand what the biomarkers are related to response that are positive predictors of response. You know, there's some inconsistent results around PD-L1, TMB. There's some intriguing clues that microbiome might be important, and we're going to talk about that in this episode. But in effect, it may be that we can test patients' levels of drug and actually extend out even more the intervals of dosing and reduce the cost to the medical community and the taxpayers. But we don't need to increase the dose to try and elicit a response. There's no relationship between the dosing and the likelihood of an adverse event.
Yeah, it's a really interesting question around the dosing of immune checkpoint inhibitors, isn't it? I think that when we did pembrolizumab studies initially, we were looking at 2 versus 10 milligrams per kg, for example, in 2 weeks or 3 weeks, for example. There was certainly a dose response in terms of the PFS curves did track slightly above at the higher dose than they did at the lower dose. We didn't relate that to adverse events particularly, but we didn't really establish what a minimum effective dose was for that. And there was that, you know, fantastic study in India that was reported at ESCO last year, I think it was, which showed that 20 mg of nivolumab was enough. And the other worry I've got around the dosing studies, a couple of things. The starters in New Zealand, we started off with a 2 mg per kg of pembrolizumab. Then they go, oh, no, fixed dose 200. But actually, there's a whole bunch of patients who are under 100 kgs who would actually get under 200 milligrams. And they change the vial size to 100 milligrams. You have to dose everyone at that level. You can't underdose anyone at 2 mg per kg anymore. So it ends up costing the taxpayer more money on the whole around that. And then the dosing intervals are all done off pharmacokinetic studies rather than actually off efficacy studies. And so it's an assumption that the pharmacokinetic modelling will translate into no difference in toxicity or no difference in efficacy, but we're accepting PK as a surrogate rather than necessarily demanding the same level of clinical data. So I think there remain some uncertainties there. I'd like to see us do more dose minimization studies and more dose duration studies, but I expect that they would be academic-led rather than pharmaceutical company-led.
Exactly.
Do you think we need to change our whole phase one philosophy? We are still throwing a lot of drug at seeing people and seeing if throwing more drug at people is better.
Yeah, for immunotherapy, that may well be the case, Kate.
And targeted therapy, you know, we know there's a differential response, for example, in everolimus. As you go from a low dose to a high dose, different things happen molecularly. And maybe we're doing the wrong thing by giving people as much as they can tolerate. Not that many people can tolerate everolimus.
Yeah, well, Kate, I think that the medical oncology approach to dosing is the same approach that we had to alcohol in first year university. And that is, if some is good, then more is better.
What do you mean university, Chris?
Is that too long ago for you, Craig?
You can call me Chucky, Craig, if you like.
So let's move along. Kate, what have you got for us this week as your long paper?
My long paper is not a new paper. It was published in JCO at the beginning of last year, but like most jobbing oncologists, I do most of my reading when I have a question about a particular human. And I've had a wee cohort recently of three DMMR gastric cancer patients who have all, for a variety of reasons, been people I didn't want to give chemotherapy to anyway, in the neoadjuvant setting. And I wanted some data to back that up because we've gone from, you know, when we all started as oncologists, we're all probably older than many of the listeners, people had surgery alone and then we went through MAGIC and then FLOT, and it's quite hard now to talk surgeons out of chemotherapy. So I wanted to see what sort of data was out there. And although the particular patient I'm talking about, sadly, doesn't have the wherewithal to use this, but I did enjoy this phase two study looking at a combination of ipi and nivolumab, because the outcomes are very reminiscent of niche two. So 60% pathological complete response rate and very high major response rates in patients who had some ipi and some nivolumab beforehand. Frustratingly, the study does have an adjuvant nivolumab component to it. And frustratingly, the ipi and nivo is about, I can't do the maths now, I think it's about three times as many doses as niche two, but with the same outcomes. So I was curious. I'm waiting for some sort of phase three. I understand that's going to be complicated, and understanding what on earth will be your comparator arm.
Yeah, well, this is a rare cancer. I can't recall one recently, Kate. We routinely test the mismatch repair gene on all colon cancer biopsies, but I can't remember the recent discussion about what to do in the neoadjuvant space. It is complicated because of the difficulty accessing the drug. I think to your point about phase threes, I think they're going to be really hard to do, right, because the data is so compelling, and we talked about it a little bit in the last episode.
I think, Craig, I'd like to move it up a bit, because I think the lower stuff, I think, is now standard of care. So rectal, colon, people will discuss MMR appropriate strategies. But I think this is interesting. This is gastric cancer, so a different cohort of patients, but very similar outcomes to niche two. Craig and Chris, what do you do for upper GI DMMR early cancers?
In the absence of a trial, Kate, I think it's a really hard discussion because we don't have great data. I mean, if a patient can afford to pay, obviously it's a discussion you would have. And the data is that we shouldn't make judgments about that. We should probably leave that up to the patient to decide about the ability to pay or not. But I think in the absence of a trial, it's quite difficult. Chris, are you able to access drug for these patients or study?
Well, not presently. I don't see that much DMMR gastric, you know, a whole lot less than you would think from the numbers that you would predict with Lynch. We certainly see an awful lot, particularly BRAF mutant colon cancer with DMMR. That's pretty common in my world. DMMR upper GI, much, much, much less common. I think more than the IO data being persuasive, I think what's interesting is that the chemo resistance data is dissuading. So, you know, the retrospective analyses from MAGIC, for example, really show that the DMMR patients are chemo refractory. And that, to me, is what would push me towards about thinking about other ones. We don't know that so much from taxanes, of course. It's more platinum fluorouracil. But I tend to think of DMMR as a relatively chemo-refractory condition.
Yeah, I think the lack of FLOT data, I think, has left in ESMO guidelines, they've left that little wiggle room. They said they don't know whether the taxane changes that, but they recommend no magic, which is a bit frustrating because it's, you know, a bit woolly, but that's where the data is. So, you know, they're not telling lies. It's just, it's frustrating. No, I think it's very much a watch this space. And I think probably, you know, if you think about in the stage four, all diseases seem to have, all DMMR diseases except pancreas, seem to have very similar response rates and very similar control times. So I think maybe that kind of neoadjuvant strategy is going to move into all of them, but I will, you know, keep my fingers crossed for more data.
Okay, why do you think pancreas is the refractory one?
Because it's my nemesis. No, I genuinely think it's because it's so clever. You know, it's that interaction between the cancer itself and it changes its whole macro and micro environment to protect itself. You know, I was very hopeful when the hyaluronidase stuff first came out, and then of course it wasn't borne out. You know, that would make a path for both chemo and immune cells to kill the cancer. I find pancreatic cancer absolutely fascinating, but I do think it's a whole of body disease that's different.
Do you hold out any hope for the AGITG Send 1 study?
Look, the data that I've seen looked fantastic, but you have to have hope.
So thanks, Kate. We seem to be increasingly talking about immunotherapy on the Oncology Journal Club podcast, and my long paper is another in the field, and we talked a little bit before about the kind of tantalizing hints that maybe microbiome is important in predicting response to immunotherapy. And so, you know, we like to blow our own trumpet in OGC, and this week's paper I was a co-author on Nature Medicine. So that was a real honour. It was one of the first tally trials we did between the Olivia Newton-John Cancer Centre in Melbourne and Bendigo and Albury-Wodonga in regional Victoria. In rare cancer patients, they were given immunotherapy, and this is one of the papers that's evolved out of the translational work looking at gut microbiome and whether there was some patterns predicting response.
And now we're going to hear a few snippets from Craig's interview with the first author of this paper, Dr. Ashray Gunjur.
One of the biospecimens that was collected from the majority of patients was a pre-treatment stool sample. So that's what we used to assess the gut microbiome, or in this case, the fecal microbiome. So we extracted the DNA from those samples, and we used something called shotgun metagenomic sequencing. So this is where it's kind of the equivalent of whole genome sequencing of the metagenomes, because there's lots of different species, lots of different genomes in that stool sample. But you have a really deep understanding of the whole genomes of what is present. And then we use some bioinformatics to not only stitch together what the bugs were at the strain level, but then also map the reads to those genomes to really get pretty accurate quantifications of how much of the bug was present in each of those pre-treatment stool samples. And then we could actually use it to predict response or progression across these very, very different cancer types, because we had that information in follow-up. And what we found was when we used the strain level information, we actually saw an improvement in the predictive performance when we cross-validated across this very diverse rare cancers cohort than when we used the more conventional species or genus-level information. So I think it, to us, really affirmed that hypothesis that having a higher resolution, higher granularity of the microbiome does actually make an improvement. And we found another interesting thing. We found that the signature from the rare cancers trial, where all patients were treated with ipi-nivo, so anti-CTLA-4, anti-PD-1, seemed to only perform well on external cohorts where the patients had received ipi-nivo, so anti-CTLA-4, anti-PD-1. So it didn't seem to perform very well. In fact, it performed like a coin toss when we tested it on patients who just received anti-PD-1 monotherapy. And this was a little bit surprising because we always thought of anti-PD-1 as kind of the workhorse. It's carrying the combination immune checkpoint blockade efficacy. But I guess when we thought more about it, it seemed like there was already evidence that the mechanism of action of combination anti-PD-1, anti-CTLA-4 was quite different, and that the addition of anti-CTLA-4 probably does make a difference, especially in the interaction with the gut microbiome. There's evidence that it can change the permeability of the gut. Obviously, colitis is a much bigger phenomenon with anti-CTLA-4 inhibition. And there was evidence from other sources of data, like immunotranscriptomic data, that the immune responses were quite different to this treatment. So it suggests to us that there is a common signature of response to immune checkpoint blockade across cancer types, but there might be different microbial signatures to different regimens, which we thought was interesting and we wanted to share.
So in summary, I think it's really important information. So the signature of response is predicated on the treatment regimen rather than cancer type, which is the conclusion in the paper. And so it serves an important knowledge base for further trials looking at microbiome diagnostics or any interventions.
If you'd like to hear more, listen to the full interview in the OJC Meets Ashray Gunjur episode, which you can find on our website, YouTube, and on streaming apps. Now, back to the team to hear what they think about this paper.
I hope you enjoyed that interview, Chris and Kate. Ashray is an incredibly impressive young clinician researcher currently in Cambridge. We hope that he'll come back to Australia one day. What did you think?
I think microbiome should be thought of as a whole other organ, and we ignore it at our peril, both in terms of developing cancers, protecting us from cancers, and obviously influencing our response to therapy. I am fascinated by the transplant of one microbiome into another person, responders and non-responders. Absolutely incredible. Hopefully some sort of clinical application in the future, you know, more gastroenterologists running around with fecal slurries to give to people. You know, I have a very skinny husband who's always teasing me that he could donate me his microbiome and I would lose some weight without any effort. I absolutely fascinating. To blow a New Zealander's trumpet, there's Dr. Rachel Purcell is a scientist in University of Otago who's doing some really interesting work about the microbiome in colon cancer. Again, I think you ignore the microbiome at your peril. Chris?
I just wonder if we should get gastroenterologists to run around without cleaning their colonoscopes.
But you don't want to get a fat, unhealthy person before you in the list, see? So you want a skinny, attractive person.
Yeah. Well, look, I think that the microbiome data is all starting to come together, isn't it? You know, we know that the impact of antibiotics has a negative effect on immune checkpoint inhibitor, which clearly is going to be mediated by the gut. You know, the potential impact of PPI, for example, on the efficacy of PD-1 inhibitors, particularly in melanoma, you know, from observational data seems to be pretty interesting. And again, that would logically be done via the impacts on the gut also. Look, I think the microbiome is fascinating. I don't understand these guys and how they study it. And I would have thought that the microbiome in the ascending colon is different to the descending colon, different in the rectum, different to the small intestine, and actually how you can study that and understand where in the colon it's impactful is interesting, because all the stuff was done from fecal samples, right? So the fecal sample won't necessarily reflect what the microbiome is doing in the upper gut level and where it is. It's important, I think.
You know, you comment that we've got evidence about PPI and giving antibiotics before. I think it's not that clear cut. You know, we could do a whole episode about microbiome and cancer, I think.
I agree that it's not a slam dunk, and there seems to be, you know, class impacts of the antibiotics, right? But I think it's data which you look at, which you can see an association between the impact of antibiotics and the response, which is observational, which is clearly pre, you know, hypothesis testing. But it's interesting, and the pathway by which it would act would clearly be the microbiome one. The other thing I really liked about that study too, Craig, was how, you know, you took the microbiome from the patient and transplanted it to the mouse, and then you tested the efficacy of the PD-1 agent and it mirrored the response in the patient. Now, that also is another emerging area that people are interested in with organoids, for example, when trying to test chemotherapy sensitivity or translocating tumour into mice and testing chemotherapy sensitivity in that way. So that's the ultimate way you can do personalised medicine. Unfortunately, it doesn't predict for toxicity. It might do for efficacy. But as a patient, it's so attractive. Can you please test my tumour for effectiveness of this chemotherapy panel or this immunotherapy panel, and having an animal model to check what later lines of therapy might actually be most useful?
Good discussion. Chris, what have you got for us today?
Well, at the end of last year, we did a review of the total neoadjuvant therapy and rectal cancer papers. And we've just had the 5-year update of the OPRA, O-P-R-A paper published in JCO. And O-P-R-A or OPRA was a randomized phase 2 study, which looked at the sequencing of chemoradiotherapy or chemotherapy in patients with locally advanced rectal cancer stage 2 or stage 3. So these were patients who predominantly had tumors within 6 centimeters of the anal verge, who were randomized to receive either radiation first, standard long course with capecitabine or 5-FU, followed by FPOX, fluoropyrimidine oxaliplatin, either CAPOX or FOLFOX, for 15 or 16 weeks, versus a reverse sequence of 16 or 15 weeks of induction chemotherapy followed by radiation. So we've either got chemo first or radiation first as the approach. And the OPRA study was looking at disease-free survival. It's primarily an organ-preserving study that was looking to see how you could get on with preserving the rectum if you got could avoid having a stoma. So that's why the lower third rectum patients were particularly the ones who were interested here. There was no comparator arm of chemoradiotherapy only, or chemo only, or surgery only, so it's only comparing the strategy there. Now, OPRA's been around for a while, and people will know the results that chemoradiotherapy first, so radiation first followed by consolidation chemo, was better in terms of TME-free survival, so organ preservation, basically. And it showed that the five-year TME-free survival was about 15-odd percent better with radiotherapy first. So you're more likely to keep your rectum if you had a stage 2, so T3, T4, or a stage 3, so TNE-N1, N2, if you had the chemoradiotherapy first. In the original publication, the local relapse was equivalent between the two arms, and the five-year disease-free survival was equivalent between the two arms. What the update, the five-year update, has shown is that DFS remains the same. Overall survival is within 3%, slight favouring for chemo first, 3% higher, non-significant. And the five-year TME-free survival was better with radiation first, 54% versus 39% with chemo first. So again, confirms that headline result. If you go radiation first, you get a 15%, 1.5, higher rate of TME-free survival. So half the patients who have this strategy can preserve their rectum and end up with no operation and without even a temporary stoma. One of the interesting things about this paper was the loco-regional free survival data. Now, when I remember back to Rapido, which was the short course followed by chemo paper, where the loco-regional failure was worse in the experimental arm with short course followed by chemo. Now, it was 4% worse in the short course followed by chemo. And what the authors hypothesized was that the extra long duration between radiation and surgery led to those who had radio-resistant clones forming a higher likelihood to have local recurrence. And the chat that I'd heard was that Rapido, people went off it, because of the 4% higher rate of loco-regional failure. And so most people were going Pradige or OPRA instead of Rapido. In the five-year update of OPRA, the loco-regional free survival actually had exactly the same difference, so 4% worse loco-regional failure in the radiation first arm. So chemo first, followed by chemo radiation, had lower rates of loco-regional failure than radiation first. So again, if you have your radiation followed by long course of chemo, you've got higher local recurrence than if you have the reverse sequence, 4%. And I don't think that's been fully digested yet. So I think that that 4% worse local recurrence seen in OPRA, same extent as seen in Rapido, needs to be thought about quite carefully. I think there's a general bias towards long course chemo radiotherapy in general against short course, but actually with the massive increases in demand for radiation, which are predicted over the next 15 years, we have to be really thoughtful about our resource using and minimizing fractionation schedules, minimizing exposure where we can, in order that we can free up capacity on these machines. And so we have to fully digest the implications of that difference when we're thinking about this strategy.
So interesting paper, Chris. So just to clarify, so this was all the patients reset had long course, chemotherapy, chemo radiotherapy, and they either watch or wait or immediate TME. Half the patients didn't need on the watch and wait, didn't need to have surgery, which is fantastic. You alluded to the short course. So has there actually been a direct comparison between neoadjuvant short course chemotherapy versus the long?
So not in the TNT setting. The short versus long was, of course, an excellent TROG study, so Australasian study.
Yeah. But in this neoadjuvant approach and then a watch and wait, have we got a comparison? Because of those resource implications and the fact that with this approach that you just talked about, where the long course we're committing, it's quite a big resource allocation, but you could hypothesize that the long course, higher dose of radiotherapy for longer might be important in achieving that 50% long-term local control.
Yeah, I think what the OPRA study shows us is that long course with a long wait with intersection of chemotherapy results in better organ preservation, but it doesn't result in better local control. So you have to be very clear about what your goal is. Is your goal to preserve local control, or is your goal to avoid a stoma and have organ preservation? And so I think having clear conversations with patients about what your goals are, is it local control? Is it organ preservation? Is it distant metastasis-free survival? What is the main goal of your therapy? Which makes this conversation about how you best approach neoadjuvant therapy in rectal cancer so much harder than it's ever been before. And I love the fact that we've actually got so many more options to discuss with our patients. We've discussed previously on this podcast the PROSPECT study, which was the chemo with selective radiation therapy. And whilst, again, that was a non-comparative study in terms of included patients who had more favourable characteristics than either Pradesh or OPRA, for example. But what it showed us is in those patients who have had previous pelvic radiotherapy could have chemo instead. So I think this is a complicated area now. We've got more options. We're having more complicated discussion with patients, more complicated discussion with the surgeons. But what's becoming increasingly clear is that for those who are T3, T4, so stage 2, or node positive, should be getting some form of neoadjuvant therapy now. Surgery alone is probably not a standard of care anymore in those intermediate patients, and that you can have the option of stoma-free survival and organ preservation in up to half the patients with stage 2 or 3 cancers in that lower third.
Yeah. What do you think, Kate? I think it's hard to have those conversations with patients. It's so confusing. It's confusing for surgeons and medical oncologists and radiation oncologists. You know, people misquote stuff in the MDTs.
I actually think this now, in my region, we have ENT combined clinics, we have gynae combined clinics, so that patient is only hears the one story after everybody's had their chance to have an argument, and you know, we're taking the patient's voice into account. I think this is something that lends itself to a patient having an, you know, proper staging and an MDT discussion before they're presented with the options that are medically possible, and then they can help make the choice based on their own priorities. Otherwise, you a little bit like the prostate cancer. You know, we know that a patient with prostate cancer meets a surgeon, they get an operation. If they meet a radiation oncologist, they may choose not to have an operation. So I really think that rectal cancer is something we need to do as a team. It is really hard. The conversations with patients, you know, that's what medocs are good at. But I think the wading through the data and figuring out what's the right horse for which course, I think that's getting really tricky. Because some of the questions we're asking haven't actually been answered. You know, compare this, compare that. Nobody's done that. They've moved things around. And, of course, every single trial has a different population in it. So it's very hard to make those decisions or even think about what the appropriate option is for each patient.
Kate, you know, resourcing, particularly radiology, is a really vexing issue in the New Zealand context. What's been your experience with accessing watch and wait because of radiology restrictions?
So actually, we were having this conversation locally because we're going to end up, for the first time, I think the surgeons are experiencing the difference between private and public care in cancer surgery. So we can do excellent TME surgery in either sector with no real wait. So whenever we want it, sorted, no problem. We cannot do 4 MRIs a year and 4 surgical outpatient appointments a year in public. So the private patients are being presented with the option of watch and wait. A public patient, it's really not an option we can honestly do in a quality-controlled fashion because we can't resource the MRIs. And that is something that I think the surgeons, you know, we're used to having unfunded conversations all the time, but I don't think that's something the surgeons are at all comfortable with. And so it's on our agenda to have a chat about whether we can figure out how many people it really is and what kind of resource it would need and whether we can make it happen.
So, Kate, I think New Zealand medical oncology has been the butt of many a joke in terms of our lack of availability of medicines. But what that has done also is it's sharpened our thinking about resource allocation and prioritisation. We've had long waiting lists for SSAs, for example. And it makes us think about bang for our buck in terms of how we prioritise access. And resource constraint in oncology is a realistic problem. And I think that the rest of the world is going to face that over the course of the next 15 years when the number of cancer diagnoses go up by 50% in that period of time, when we don't have enough investment in linear accelerators in the public sector, where we don't have enough surgeons who are training, we don't have enough medical oncologists. We are going to have to be people who are into demand management. And the current approach in oncology of treatment intensification needs to go in the other direction, which is treatment de-intensification whilst maintaining efficacy, minimising contact with healthcare professionals and minimising toxicity.
I don't at all disagree, Chris. I will need a statistician to explain to me why any treatment minimisation has to be done via a non-inferiority trial, which are almost impossible to prove. So I need somebody to explain to me why, because I think that's a real problem in our data. Whenever we try and take something away, we have to do it via a non-inferiority trial, and then it can never be proven because of the nature of those very trials.
I'm going to play the devil's advocate. So I think we should be advocating for the best possible treatment for the patient. And then it's up to the discussion about restriction on access and funding is a separate kind of thing. So that's what I think our focus should be in putting forward options, not predicate it with resource limitation.
So look, I think that's a really, really good point, Craig. You know, I live in a town of 150,000 people. And when I go to the supermarket, people who are on the waiting list see me. And I get phone calls and people call me and they ask to be pushed up the waiting list. So I'm managing that waiting list personally, individually for the patients. So the patients who I'm not seeing are very much as much my patients as the ones who I am seeing. So when you talk about treatment intensification and advocating for the patient in front of you, I'm also dealing with the people who are on my waiting list who I'm not currently seeing. And they are also my responsibility. So when you say the patient is your responsibility, actually, in my opinion, the community is my responsibility. And actually looking at how I best meet the needs of the entire community and deliver services for them is part of my job.
Now, I think we should be advocating for de-intensification if necessary. And that's, you know, through trials, we've had some Twitter discussion about that. But I think the number one job in an MDT is to come up with the ideal options that you can then go away and discuss with the patient. I don't think you should predicate that with, oh, we're not going to be able to do the wait and watch because we haven't got x-ray time. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, no, I really agree with that, Craig.
Then we need to be advocating with the funders as to why that's, we need to find the resources to do that. So I don't think we should be cutting corners for the sake of just rolling over and saying, oh, we've got to cut corners.
That's really nuanced though, Craig. So I think, yes, you can have an MDT conversation where you say, this is what we'd like to do for this patient. And if you think about, well, for example, you know, so we had a DMMR colon patient. I knew exactly what we wanted to do for that patient. So we wanted to do niche two. That is not available in the public sector. I had to go and approach the patient with, these are your options, one of which is an unfunded option. Here's the pluses and minuses of each option. He went away with his family. They thought for 10 days. They found the 35 grand and they came back. You know, those are the kind of conversations that we will all be having.
Yeah, that's right.
And the sad part is, yes, we do have to come up with a genius, you know, best possible plan, but we have to then present it to the patient in a way that is understanding of what they're actually going to be able to get, but also respectful of the fact that, if it is something that they're going to have to come up with money for, that we shouldn't be making any judgments about what patients value and what they might have the ability to fund. But you can have both things going on at once.
Yeah, that's right. The literature will tell us that we shouldn't prejudge ability. They want to know what the options are, and then they will decide.
And I also strongly agree with you, Craig, that we shouldn't be rationing at an individual level. So clinicians shouldn't be saying, well, this is a cheaper treatment, therefore I'll do this for this particular patient, you know, here. But I think that responsibility on us as oncologists who are researchers and who are oncologists who are decision makers is looking to influence the research strategies that we employ to focus on not only thinking about best possible treatments or most intensive treatment, but also having a very keen eye on the resource implications of the types of research we do, the types of research questions we ask, the structure of the studies that we do, and thinking about the impacts of that resource consumption on the patients who are waiting to be seen.
Yeah. So, Kate, I think your idea about the combined clinic's a great one. There's the next health services research grant. If it's not already being done, but I think that's a really good idea that exploring that model and evaluating it, co-designing it with consumers, including First Nations people. So maybe we can write a grant application together.
Craig, have you ever seen combined clinics done via telehealth or telemedicine?
No, I've seen MDTs, but not that kind of arrangement. So that's a good one.
Would that be something that would work, do you think, or not?
To do?
Yeah.
Potentially, it might be able to be done in the public sector where people are paid. In the private sector, when there's no item numbers to do that, might be more difficult, but it's a good thought. So moving right along, Kate, can you tell us about your quick bites?
Yeah, so these are very quick bites. The first one is just, can I get everybody to read the paper, please? So it's in ESMO Open, which means it's available to everyone, and it's looking at sexual health and breast cancer survivors. The rates of lack of sexual enjoyment and decrease in sexual function is 80-90%. And there are lots of practical things that women and their carers and their loved ones can do to improve their outcomes. And they're not tricky. The most important thing that I practice in my own practice of these patients, not my own practice of the other thing, is to talk about it. Because I think if you actively ask your breast cancer survivors how sex is going, they will tell you. And it's not just menopause. There's a lot of other stuff going on, including the fact that we borrow these women's bodies for a year. So, yeah, please read the paper and have a think about how you can improve this, something that's just so very important in people's lives.
But isn't that a question we should be asking all our patients? I'm sure it's a particular issue in breast cancer with all the hormone changes, et cetera, estrogen withdrawal. But now that you said that, I was thinking, oh, it's something we probably should ask people, but we don't necessarily. Maybe the nurses do, but the doctors don't.
Yeah, I worked with a great gynae surgeon who, he was blunt, but he used to talk about the three S's, which was sitting, shitting, and sex. And although that was facetious, it is actually quite helpful for, you know, post-gynae cancer survival, particularly with radiotherapy to pelvises and things. So I think we need to talk about it more and perhaps school ourselves up in how to have those conversations, but also what tools are out there to help women. And, you know, I'm sure men can do with some help too.
Cancer, obviously, is a median age of people in the mid-60s. You know, we don't like to think about people of our parents' generation having sex. But, of course, it's a really important element of people's overall happiness and life contentment, isn't it? And that's part of patient-centered medicine. I think it's a big conversation, though, Kate, you know, and it's a difficult conversation to have in a compressed outpatient appointment. It's one of those things that get easily dropped off the agenda of the many things that we have to do in a compressed outpatient appointment.
Chris, 60s is not my parents' generation, but anyway, great paper, Kate. We'll just move along. Thanks for pointing that out. Everyone should read that. ESMO Open. And then your second one?
No, my second one is actually apropos after we've been talking about microbiome, because, of course, microbiome includes pathogens. And there's about four papers, but this is one of them, connecting H. pylori with colorectal cancer. You know, it may well be a indicator of poor health access or poverty, but there is definitely an increase in incidence and in mortality from colorectal cancer in those patients with H. pylori, particularly untreated H. pylori. So don't think about your microbiome at your peril. You know, I keep saying that. I think there's so much more in that. We live with a whole community of creatures, some of whom have not got our best interests at heart.
So, Kate, is the implication of that, then if we have a patient with colon cancer, we should do a breath test and then treat H. pylori? Have we got strong evidence of intervening?
This is epidemiological, and, you know, there's lies, damn lies in epidemiology. But you know, I think there's about four different papers from four different groups of researchers, so I think that's coming. I would like to, if we go back a step in terms of quality, could you hand on heart say you're doing that for every gastric cancer patient at the moment? I think ESMO checklists have just come out in some cancers, and I look at them and think, God, I'm sure I'm doing everything on that list. I'm sure I'm not. So I think in terms of quality, maybe we hit the one where we know it matters first, and this is in the to be announced.
Kate, with the epidemiological studies, that's clearly a life course risk factor. Is there anything that you could read in that paper around critical periods of exposure to H. pylori in terms of where it might be important that you're exposed to that in your development?
No, that was a large age group. It's a 15-year time difference. So I don't think that they're able to say, are you looking at why are we getting so many young people with colon cancer?
If you look at the epidemiology of GI cancer in general, you see the incidence dropping in elderly but going up in the youngsters. And it has, you know, the incidence change is in keeping with an infectious disease. It's not in keeping with a founder effector genomic influence. It's environmental exposure, of which impact on the microbiome, again, seems most likely to be whether that's dietary or antibiotic usage or whatever. It's fascinating. Again, you mentioned earlier our colleague, Dr. Rachel Purcell from Christchurch, who did a stool sample on patients from the Christchurch cohort who found Bacteroides fragilis, again, was associated with a higher rate of bowel cancer incidence in New Zealand. And again, you've now presented the paper on H. pylori. And Craig, you've got the paper today on the whole genome signature as to how that might impact on incidence. It's interesting to know at what stage in your life course that's important. It's interesting to know what impact, as you say, Kate, is to do with confounding and how much of that's overcrowding, poverty, diet exposures that are also correlated with those bacteria to give you that risk. But what's clear is that we need to understand it better and look at what interventions are going to make a difference.
I think that the early onset colorectal cancer stuff is frankly terrifying. I'm preparing a chat for some radiation oncologists tomorrow, and the talk is breast cancer and pregnancy. But when I look through my cases, I've got one, but I've got three women with colorectal cancer and pregnancy. That wouldn't have been what I would have guessed when I had a thought of when I trawled through. So I think we've got a lot of work to do in that space, not only to treat these people properly, and obviously, despite Chris's attempt at being non-age biased, the sexual function in 20 and 30-year-olds is perhaps more of a concern. But these people have lifelong toxicities ahead of them, so it would be lovely to not be looking at total neoadjuvant therapy in 25-year-olds.
Great. Thank you. Good discussion. So I've got a couple of quick bites, and so I picked these on the basis of them being potentially answering kind of real everyday questions, one in GI cancer and one in lung cancers. The first one is a paper by Sun et al. In JAMA Oncology, Association between Duration of Immunotherapy and Overall Survival in Advanced Non-Small Cell Lung Cancer. So we've known in the past there was a randomized study stopping after a year of immunotherapy. You can see the New Zealanders' eyes are glazing over by giving immunotherapy lung cancer. So a randomized trial stopping after a year, and patients who stopped early didn't seem to do as well and didn't necessarily respond on being re-challenged with immunotherapy. This is a retrospective study, large series, looking at the question of stopping after 2 years, and it appeared to be minimal difference between the two groups. So some prospective studies specified 2 years of immunotherapy and then stopping, others continue with the immunotherapy, which obviously has big cost implications for the system. So again, this is a retrospective study, but it appears to show minimal difference. So it does give some reassurance to having a discussion with patients at 2 years about whether you can discontinue their checkpoint inhibitor. But I think the definitive randomized trial probably needs to be done. And the second one is in rechallenge after oxaliplatin-induced hypersensitivity reactions. Again, in JAMA Oncology, it was a letter to the editor from French medical oncologist Rassi et al. And this is the largest reported series to date of rechallenging people who've had a hypersensitivity reaction to oxaliplatin. In the past, we've tended to probably, someone's had a reaction, we just go, okay, well, we're going to, you know, we pre-medicate them next time they have another reaction, then we just stop it. And there's been some rechallenge protocols around. So this is the largest series to date where patients are given more extensive pre-medication. They're kept as an inpatient, given very slow infusions. And the vast majority of them were able to get through without having a repeat reaction. And if they did have a repeat reaction, no one died or ended up in ICU or had anaphylaxis. So that's kind of reassuring. So Chris and I had some chat on WhatsApp about a case. So Chris, in your practice, do you very often rechallenge these patients who've had an oxaliplatin-induced hypersensitivity reaction?
I think one of the interesting things that came out of a discussion around this on our WhatsApp group, Craig, was the fact that because New Zealand has fewer options, we end up rechallenging patients with previous agents not infrequently. And I think that we've known for some time that when you rechallenge someone with cisplatin or carboplatin, the rates of hypersensitivity go up and the gynae guys are quite used to doing desensitization. Perhaps in GI cancer, we don't do that as much because people have had neuropathy. But in New Zealand, where you've got a limited range of options, you tend to rechallenge people when you're getting to third or fourth line therapy. So we do that a lot, and I see a remarkable amount of hypersensitivity to oxaliplatin on the second, third, fourth infusion of rechallenge. We've had really good experiences with desensitization, and we've managed to get most of our patients to have the agent reintroduced using a protocol. One in particular who has had anaphylaxis, proper anaphylaxis, not hypersensitivity. I think it would take a very courageous clinician to rechallenge them, and that's, I'm not brave enough quite to do that yet.
Okay. So Chris, do you have some short bites for us?
Yeah. Well, here is the news. First of all, New Zealand's Parliament has voted to reverse several important pieces of legislation which impact on cancer rates in the New Zealand environment. The last week, we've seen the new coalition government reverse New Zealand's world-leading smoke-free legislation. So the smoke-free legislation in New Zealand was designed to have a inverse sinking lid by raising the age at which you would be able to buy tobacco. So 18, then 19, then 20, then 21. To be a whole generation of kids, those born in 2009 or after, who would never be able to buy smoked tobacco. They would reduce the number of tobacco outlets from something like 600 to 60, I think, so quite a small number of tobacco outlets to make tobacco more difficult to get. and would denicotinize cigarettes. They'd take the nicotine out, so 5% of current nicotine levels in cigarettes, in order to get a truly smoke-free generation. New Zealand's making good progress in smoke-free in general, with fewer than 6% or 7% of New Zealanders smoking daily, but there's still stark ethnic inequalities, with Māori and Pacific are more likely to smoke around about 17% to 20-odd percent, I think the latest numbers are. And so removing this legislation will have a disparate impact on those Indigenous communities. The legislation reversal has been met with derision by the wider medical community. There are libertarians and tribalists who've tried to defend the legislation reversal. But it's also a shame to see some in-game tobacco legislation reversed, which could have been a blueprint for the rest of the world. The tobacco lobby is alive and well, and underestimate it at your peril.
Yeah, thanks, Chris. There are no words, really. And what's your second bit of cheery good news?
In New Zealand, we had the Māori Health Authority, whose sole goal was to reduce ethnic inequalities and outcomes for health. Of course, we have stark ethnic inequalities in cancer outcomes, with Māori 20% more likely to get cancer and twice as likely to die from cancer, and a variety of other ethnic inequalities in cardiovascular disease, infectious disease, diabetes, etc. The Māori Health Authority was a bi-Māori, for-Māori commissioning agency who's designed to work with local agencies in order to commission local services to get services to local communities. Now, you can't get away from the social determinants of health, but still, access to healthcare is critical for these communities. The Māori Health Authority has been going for just over a year, and unfortunately, again, the coalition government has disestablished this, again, world-leading Indigenous commissioning body before it's had chance to establish its feet and to have chance to have an impact. So that's, again, been a sad day. That's going to be incorporated in our Ministry of Health, so it will mean that the Māori Health Authority will report to the ministry, so perhaps no net loss of investment, but certainly a major difference in autonomy and independence of that group. So it's a shame it never got off the ground properly. My quick bites this week are olanzapine 2.5 versus 10 milligrams to prevent chemotherapy-induced nausea and vomiting. The single-center, open-label, randomized phase 3 non-inferiority trial conducted at Tata in Mumbai looked at patients receiving AC or cisplatin greater than 70 mg per meter squared who got standard antibiotic prophylaxis with dexamethasone, aprepitant, and 5-HT3 antagonists, and patients got either olanzapine high dose 10 milligrams or 2.5 milligrams. And bottom line is no difference in the rates of complete control of nausea or vomiting, but less sedation. Many of us were already using 5 milligrams. Now I think the study gives us confidence to use 2.5 and to get away from the sedation impact. Great study, super cheap, practice changing in my opinion. Let's lower the dose of olanzapine. Another great study, which was in JCO just this last month, was a review of the E1912 trial, which was a CLL study of ibrutinib versus FCR. But the interesting thing about this study was that it looked at the importance of grade 1 or 2 adverse events in treatment discontinuation rates. And what it found is, as you had grade 1 or 2 adverse events, so if you had grade 1 adverse events, you had a 13% increased likelihood of discontinuing your chemo. If you had a grade 2 adverse event, you had a 35% likelihood of discontinuing your chemotherapy. So next time you hear an ASCO plenary discussant or speaker saying this treatment was well tolerated and had manageable toxicities, think about the grade 1, 2 side effects and what that might do to discontinuation and therefore what that might do to efficacy. These grade 1, 2 toxicities, they matter. Patient experience matters.
Great. Thank you. It's great. There's so much to talk about. It's fantastic. Thanks again, Kate and Chris and Rachel on the sound desk there. Thanks to all the listeners. Thank you for sending all the positive feedback. Keep it coming. If you have particular papers you want to suggest to us, please send them in. And thanks again, everybody.
You've been listening to the Oncology Journal Club podcast, proudly produced by the Oncology Podcast, part of the Oncology Network. For regular news and podcast updates, we invite healthcare professionals to join us at oncologynetwork.com.au. Your free registration includes a free subscription to our weekly publication, The Oncology Newsletter, and it's a fantastic way to support the OJC. And don't forget to shout out any feedback or paper recommendations to us via our socials. This is Rachel Babin, and this is the Oncology Journal Club podcast.